or the First Coast area in general. It's political news. It's entertainment news. It's the latest news about the nonprofits that are doing great work here on the First Coast. Melissa Ross brings all of it. Carrie Speckman comes in every Thursday to talk about the most interesting events that are coming up over the weekend. We have Sports with Cole on Monday. It's a little bit of something for everybody here on First Coast Connect. So if you love First Coast Connect like we do, call us now, 353-9528, or go to wjct.org/thank you and become a sustainer today. And we thank you to everyone who has already given during this fall pledge drive here at WJCT.
Thanks, everyone.
As the new film Sully hits theaters, a local passenger who was aboard that fateful flight shares his memories. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app and watch the show video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, a local passenger who survived that famous Miracle on the Hudson flight, along with all the other folks on board, takes your calls. Share your thoughts and questions now at 549-2937. Plus, it's a very timely memoir of Cuban immigration from local author Maricela Viega. Then later, a look at Hunger Action Month, all of that ahead. But first this hour, the emergency plane landing that inspired the new Tom Hanks, Clint Eastwood film, Sully, became known, of course, as the Miracle on the Hudson. All 155 passengers survived that incident. It happened on January 15, 2009. The dramatic landing occurred after a U.S. Air flight had both engines disabled after striking a large flock of geese. Captain Chesley Sullenberger made a quick and life-saving decision to land the plane right into the Hudson River's icy waters just minutes after leaving LaGuardia Airport in New York. Now, Donald C. Jones, CEO of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists here in Jacksonville, just happened to be on that flight. And he confirms, as he lived through it, the landing really was miraculous. Jones joins us now with his thoughts and memories of the Miracle on the Hudson incident, the Sully film, and more. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. And as the film Sully is in theaters this week, we want your thoughts and questions as we speak with passenger Donald C. Jones of Jacksonville. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And as Mr. Jones shares his memories, let's listen right now to the trailer from the new film starring Tom Hanks as Captain Sullenberger.
No one warned us. No one said you were going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
That's Tom Hanks's Sully. Donald Jones, you saw the film last night in San Marco. What did you think?
Well, actually, I saw it Thursday night.
The
premiere when it first came out. I will tell you that based on the experience that I had and what I kind of expected when they do movies, that it might be over-dramatized, this was very accurate. So I was very pleased with the way they did it. They both did a great job. Tom Hanks really portrayed Sully very closely and personality. And what you saw in Tom Hanks is what you get in Sully's personality.
And, of course, you got to know him a little bit after the incident occurred. But on that day, that January day in 2009, I'm sure it was just another business flight for you, right?
It was. I had been in New York. We do a thyroid awareness campaign every year for thyroid disease. We were up there in New York during satellite media tours for both TV and radio. Mm-hmm. And the day that we finished on that Thursday, I was scheduled to come home. And I got up that morning, and it was snowing. It was ugly. The river was choppy. The Hudson was. Both rivers were, actually, the East River and the Hudson. And I just assumed I was not even going to get out that day. But by about 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, it just all cleared out, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And the river settled down quite a bit, almost smooth. So all of that was part of many, many things that had to, had a role in how this event turned out.
It's 549-2937 to share your thoughts and questions about the Miracle Hudson flight with local survivor Donald C. Jones. So you're on the plane. It takes off. Regular, uneventful takeoff. What are your memories of what happened next?
Well, it was. It looked like a normal takeoff. It was, as I mentioned, it was a beautiful day. It goes down the runway, and we take off. And 90 seconds into the flight, and he mentioned 2,800 feet. Well, actually, I just learned that. I thought it was 3,100 feet, so it even worse.
Even lower.
But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there was this just shudder. Some people described it as an explosion. I describe it, from what I've heard, was a real strong rumble, like, whoa! And I thought, my goodness, and the gentleman sitting next to me, I was on the aisle in 3C up front, and we looked at each other, and I said to him, I said, that did not sound good. But then everything went silent. The lights flickered off. They came back on, but then there was just dead silence. Mm-hmm. And then until the last few seconds, and I guess we'll get to that.
Sure, sure. It's amazing to me, too. People on this flight remember the seat assignment they had. You remember that. It's burned in. I interviewed another survivor, Casey Jones, no relation to you. He remembered what seat he was in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't forget those things.
So everything goes quiet, and then you hear the captain speak.
No, you don't hear anything for the next 3.5 minutes. It was
okay.
It was a total of a 5-minute flight. So the reason you didn't hear anything is because here you've lost both engines. You are now descending. And you got to remember how low you are. So there's no margin for error because he was heading up over the Bronx. So he turned and banked the plane around like he was heading back toward LaGuardia. But that whole time, he was on the radio with the air traffic controller deciding. The first thing he said to Jeff Skiles, his co-pilot, was my airplane, because that's what happens on a flight when captain takes over.
Mm-hmm.
So all that time, he was trying to decide what to do with this plane. And the air traffic controller was trying to get him to come back to LaGuardia. And he already knew that he couldn't make it back. So
he made a very, almost a split-second decision that there would not be enough time to turn the plane around and that his only option was a water landing.
Well, yes. Ultimately, they even considered Teterboro, which is a small airport on the New Jersey side. Mm-hmm. He looked at that, and he finally said, can't make it. We'll be in the Hudson.
And as we learn in this film, he had to justify that decision to the authorities. We'll talk about that, too. But as the plane, when did you realize this plane is going into the water?
Not until the last minute, because from the very beginning, because, sitting up front, I couldn't tell what was going on in the back. So there was a little bit more anxiety because people could see the smoke coming from those engines and flames where they had ingested those birds, and they fried those geese. Now I hate geese. So at any rate, I couldn't see all that. And so I had a little bit of a false sense of security, primarily because nothing was being said. So I thought, okay, something's gone wrong here. He's turned this plane around. He's headed back to LaGuardia. We're just going to re-land. So I never, up until he comes on and said what he said, the captain, brace for impact. Those are the only two words he said. No, he said, this is your captain, brace for impact. Up until then, I was absolutely sure that he had found a place to land that plane. Even up until the time I began to see the shoreline, the opposite shoreline, then I realized, okay, he's coming down somewhere. He's found a place to land. Well, shortly thereafter, once I could see that other shoreline from where I was sitting, that's when he came on and said, this is your captain, brace for impact. And that's when the flight attendants, they hadn't said a thing before then because they didn't know. He didn't have time to tell anybody.
Right, right. It was that quick.
Right, it was that quick.
What was it like when the plane went into the water?
It was a pretty good jolt. More so in the back of the plane because he made such a perfect landing and he came down tail first, so that received the brunt of the impact up front. It was a pretty good jolt. It did push you forward. But I've been on some pretty rough flights before, so this wasn't much worse than some of the ones I've been on. Yeah. And then the plane just kind of flopped down, and it's a wonder it didn't break up because that's usually what happens. If it had not been for the way he was able to land that plane would have come apart. Now, it did severely damage the left engine. If you're facing the front, it would be the left engine, and that was the side I was sitting on. And it turned the plane around, so it was going in the opposite direction down the river with the current.
We'll go to your calls for Miracle on the Hudson passenger, Donald C. Jones, a local CEO, in just a moment as the new movie Sully hits theaters, the number 549-2937. He really did have the perfect skill set to land this plane successfully, as we all later learned. But then, after it went into the water, how long did it take you to get out on that wing?
Not very long, and I was not in the wing. I was in the water.
You went into the water.
I went out the front, left exit on the pilot side, and down the chute and ended up in the water. So I made it over to the wing, and I was trying to find a place to hold on because it was so icy. Mm-hmm. You got to remember the water temperature was like 34 degrees, and the air surface temperature was 20, and a wind chill factor of minus five. So I was trying to find, I went all the way to the end of the wing trying to find something to hold on to because of the ice, and I couldn't. So then I said, okay, let me try to get back over to the chute. And I started to try to swim back over. It's much farther than you might think from that wing over to that front door.
Uh-huh.
Because that's a wide wingspan on those planes. And I took about five strokes, and then all of a sudden, all that adrenaline just stopped, and my body went numb. And I knew I couldn't make it. So I turned around, and I managed to make it back to the wing. And then I was holding on. There was a flap on the front that was down, and I was holding on to that flap of the plane to stay afloat.
And did someone help fish you out of the water?
Finally, when the ferries came, and they had a hard time getting up there because of the currents. And I even had trouble because you have to climb up this, what they call a Jacob's ladder, that's got these little squares. And in the movie, I can tell you, my experience was it was a lot higher, a higher climb than what it showed in the movie because I'm in the water. So that was pretty tough. And if had it not been, I had no feeling except in my feet. And I have to tell you real quickly, the reason I did, I wear Johnston & Murphy shoes, and I had a brand new pair, and they're so well insulated. I even wrote them a letter telling them how great these shoes were because that was the only way I was able to climb up there by pushing with my feet I had no feelings. I had to loop my wrist over and push up with my feet, and it's those shoes that got me up there.
They should have put you in a commercial.
Well, they tried. they did that. They actually sent me two new pair. They sent a guy down and did the PR department. They wanted me to do a lot of promotion for them. I said, no, I don't want to exploit this. They sent me two pair of new shoes and a nice piece of luggage.
Aw, so, how about that? Well, let's go to your calls right now as we speak with local CEO Donald Jones. He was on that fateful Miracle on the Hudson flight, and he's sharing his memories as the new Tom Hanks film Sully hits theaters. It's 549-2937. Ira is on the south side of Jacksonville. Hey, Ira, good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks, Mr. Jones, for sharing your story. I have a question about survivor's remorse. I was involved, I'm U.S. Army Airborne retired. I was involved in a military plane crash in 1985, 12 December 85, where I lost 248 of my soldiers.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And so I have a sort of odd question for you. Every time I see a news report about a plane crash, I have issues. Do you have any like issues with survivor's remorse? And thank you for your story. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Sure.
Thank
yeah, thank you for that.
Well, you can't help but have some, and obviously you always feel badly about whenever you see a crash. And I have to tell you that part of my job for the last 40 years has been a lot of travel and flying. So I've never been a totally comfortable flyer. I don't like rough weather. I never like takeoffs and landings because I know that's probably the most dangerous time below 10,000 feet. So you always feel something, but not as badly here because of the outcome and that the fact that everybody survived. But certainly you do think about it, and you think about what could have happened in a worst-case scenario. And I will tell you to this day that every time I get on a plane, the worst part for me is takeoffs, which I just do not like. And you always say a little prayer like, Lord, please get this plane off the ground.
Sure.
So, but other than that, not so badly as much as you might think. Now, that's me. There are people that were on that plane who wouldn't even get on a plane again, and I'm sure that everybody had a different reaction. I guess I'm just a little hard-headed and perhaps not totally realistic and just don't expect that something like that, people will tell you it'll never happen again. I said, well, don't ever say that, but let's hope not.
Share your fear of flying if you have it with us at 549-2937. And here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page from Rob. Does anyone know how this plane didn't sink? It's amazing it was able to float in the water like this. I think the image of that is what really stuns so many people around the world. This big jet just floating in the water with all of you passengers standing on the wings. But the captain knew it could float.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important because of the type of aircraft it was. It was an A320 Airbus. It has approximately, I think, 110-foot wingspan. So you have a large plane, so you have the advantage of having wide wings. And had it been a smaller plane, it probably would have sank a lot quicker. It stayed afloat for about 30 minutes. And they did manage to get everybody off.
Why don't you turn that off as you keep talking?
I'm trying.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any rate, so that was the fortunate thing about it. It did stay afloat. But you couldn't have been on the plane because if you saw the movie or if you have seen the movie, you will see, and it was accurate, that the plane, nobody could have been on that plane because it was almost up. It wouldn't have lasted much longer. The only reason it didn't sink totally is because they were able to secure it and get it over to the shoreline.
And this is a captain who had studied water landings. He was probably one of the few captains who might have had the perfect amount of training and preparation to make this sort of landing. So it was very lucky.
Correct.
Yeah.
I would just tell you quickly, even if you see the movie, I highly recommend reading the book Sully, because it tells you about his entire life and all the experiences and the teachings and everything that he did and airline safety, interest in water landings. He'd been a jet pilot in the Air Force. Just all of the experiences and the people he had worked with over the years, that taught him, from the guy that taught him to fly in the first place, all of that added up to this particular point and played a significant role in the outcome.
And as we learn in the film, the captain then had to go through an ordeal in explaining the sequence of events. Was that something you were aware of?
Yes. Now, the movie might have made it look a little bit harsher than what I've been told it really was, but the National Transportation Board hearings, this went on for months and months and months because they were really trying to determine, I guess you kind of expect this from the airlines because they're trying to protect themselves and also their insurers, but really to try to point toward, they initially tried to make it look like it was pilot error, that he could have made it back to LaGuardia, and it took those entire hearings to prove them wrong, mm-hmm. which ultimately happened. But he had it was a rough ordeal for him, and it tells you a lot about the character of this man as to how he got through that. But I really do feel that people would really get a look. It's a very, very well-written book. It comes in paperbacks, less than $10, mm-hmm. but it's worth the read.
What's it like to go see an incredible event you live through up on the big screen? That's not an experience most people have in their lives.
No, it was interesting. I didn't know what to expect. My wife says that I was kind of twitching in my seat. I probably didn't pay any attention to that, but I'm sure I was, because some of those events, when they're replayed and you're actually looking at them in retrospect, it does get to you, because you haven't thought, you know, you haven't really focused on it in a long time. But here it is right in front of you one more time.
Other people who survived that flight say it really was a life-altering experience for them. Did you find that to be the case for you as well?
Yes, in many ways. I'm a workaholic, always have been. So, you know, I focus a lot on that. So I don't let it be a distraction. But it does certainly, it's a wake-up call about, you know, how uncertain life can be, and something can happen at any time that you least expect. Who would have thought that, if, you know, it could have been something mechanical, but it wasn't. Or it could have been just plain pilot error. It was not either of that. It was those birds. Mm-hmm. And they had no warning, because they didn't even show up on the radar. And they were just on top of them before they even realized it. And that was, you know, that was totally unexpected.
It's fascinating to speak with you, and thanks for sharing your story.
Okay, thank you.
He's Donald C. Jones, CEO of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, and the new movie Sully is in theaters now. Much more still ahead on the program, but right now we want you to support WJCT. Here's how.
All you need to do is give us a call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. Good morning. I'm Kevin Mershart, producer for First Coast Connect. Great conversation today. Yeah, fascinating stuff today about with Mr. Jones and Miracle on the Hudson. And what do you like about the movie Sully? I got to talk to him a little bit before the show started about his thoughts on that and the movie, and how this stuff, we talked about it, how this has basically kind of changed his life. It's a fascinating conversation that we bring to you every single day on First Coast Connect, and we're able to do that because you call in and show your financial support. So give us a call right now. We are over the $14,000 mark. We need to raise $72,000 by the close of business Friday. So we are past halfway here, but we're not close to halfway of our goal. So make the call now, and thank you very much. 353-9528. 1-800-722-9528. Go online at wjct.org, and don't forget, join us at $10 a month. Become a sustainer at $10 a month, and we'll send you a nice thank you gift, a stainless steel water bottle, which you can carry around with you if you go out to the, maybe you're going to go running, or you go to the gym or something like that. It'll be there with you, and you can show off that you are a supporter of WJCT. But you need to make that call now, and thank you very much. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, members of more than 200 Native American tribes expand protests over the construction of a controversial oil pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois. What's next in the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline and renewed debate over tribal rights?
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
WJCT is a community-supported station, and your contribution helps programs like our radio reading service for those who are visually impaired or have difficulty handling printed materials. If you'd like to specifically help radio reading, denote that on your check and send it to us at WJCT, 100 Festival Park Avenue, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202. And thanks for helping us give voice to the printed word.
On the next episode of Hometown, the Tales program matches together local shelter dogs and inmates for training and rehabilitation. WeCare's Beaches Health and Wellness Program partners with local organizations to provide social and medical services to people in need. Family Foundation's 1000 and 1000 program develops personalized strategies to help the working poor escape poverty. And local musician Monique Cancera performs her song, Nowhere to Go. Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
Welcome back. Well, there's been a lot of heightened interest in Cuba lately due to the move by the U.S. to reestablish ties with the communist island nation. Against that political backdrop, one local author is set to give a very timely talk this Saturday at the Florida Heritage Book Festival. St. Augustine resident author and Flagler professor Maricela Vega joins us now with more about that and what's inside the pages of her new book, We Carry Our Homes With Us, a Cuban-American Memoir. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And as we discuss interest in Cuba, maybe you're interested in traveling to Cuba and you have questions about Cuba, give us a call at 549-2937. This is a fascinating memoir, and it's a story of Cuban immigration that is not expected. What I did not know until learning of your story that some Cuban exiles were resettled outside of Miami in the early 1960s. Your family was one of them.
Yes, we were.
You went to Minnesota.
Yes.
Of all places.
I know. It's crazy.
And how did that... So Cuban family leaving, coming to America, seeking refuge, a new life. You end up in Minnesota. How did that happen?
First, we landed in Miami, as many, so many Cuban refugees did. And after a while, my father and mother decided to sign up for a resettlement because so many refugees were coming in at the time, to the tune of 1,800 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no jobs there. It was just flooded with people.
Where were you staying during that time?
We had various homes in Miami, including relatives who hosted us and two rentals of small houses.
But you couldn't make ends meet.
No, yeah. With both my parents working outside of their... Well, my father had some work related to his profession. My mother did not, but she was working.
Yeah. And so you applied for resettlement, and the government sent you all the way to frigid Minnesota.
Well, we had an option. My father had options, and they had some job interviews lined up for, you know, whoever was planning to resettle. And Minnesota looked like the best option. And he signed up at the refugee center, and four different nonprofit agencies worked to help the refugees resettle. It wasn't just the federal government. It was the federal government in collaboration with nonprofits and other civic groups.
And as we learn in your memoir, when your family traveled to Minnesota, there were only 16 Cubans in the entire state of Minnesota at the time.
Yes.
And you added to that number.
Yes. My sister was born there. She was born there, and she's truly a Minnesota Cuban.
And when you describe yourself that way, what does that mean to you? You are a Minnesota Cuban.
My formative years were spent in Minnesota. I learned to speak English in Minnesota, and my first elementary school days from kindergarten to fifth grade. And so I think my use of language definitely, but a lot of things that are not natural to Cubans, like ice skating. I have played hockey. I've gone sledding. I like to think a lot of appreciation for Nordic things.
Yeah. But at the same time, your family had a lot of experiences that are common for a refugee family coming in somewhere new.
Yes.
You have some powerful memories of that as well.
Yes. I think what has become most notable to me, and part of the reason that the memoir has been so satisfying to write, was that my parents did not focus on what they left behind. They were very focused on surviving and making a home for themselves and learning the ropes. Mm-hmm. And so the history that came before, for the most part, had to be ignored in order for our family to move forward. And that's very common to immigrants and refugees and exiles.
As we talk about the immigrant and refugee experience in this country with author Maricela Vega, give us a call with your thoughts about that at 549-2937. This year, we've seen a contentious and sometimes a bitter debate in this country about allowing in immigrants and refugees.
Yes.
What is your reaction to that as someone who, as a child, had that experience?
What I like to say to people is when you are beginning to consider immigration to this country and who is allowed to get in and who is not allowed to get in, I recommend that people take on the serious study of the U.S. relationship to the country of origin, where those people are coming from. And after they understand what that relationship has been, then make a better informed decision about the immigration policy.
You would like to read an excerpt from your book.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great.
And this is We Carry Our Homes With Us, a Cuban-American memoir.
My father, Miguel Vega, watched the rural landscape roll by from the window of a station wagon, disturbed by what he saw. The architecture of Midwestern farming was new to him. Big red barns, silver silos, tightly planted cornfields rolling for acres toward the sky. And now, thanks to his American host, the Lauer Farm in Mendota Heights, Minnesota, was where his next home, though temporary, would be. In a week's time, my mother and siblings and I would join him. A few short years before, he and my mother had chosen the fishing village of Cojimar for their home. In 15 minutes, they would be in cosmopolitan Havana. My father loved the city, especially for its architectural elegance. That was before. This was now. Cubans are familiar with sugarcane fields, banana plantations, and citrus groves. In addition to those, my father knew coastal landmarks, especially docks, fishing fleets, and warehouses storing natural sponges. His father had worked in that industry on both the southern and northern coast of Cuba. At 39, he and my mother, Maria Gonzalez de Vega, 36, had decided to move from Miami, their initial place of exile, to the upper Midwest. The move to Minnesota was miles from the subtropics and even farther from a past that remained hidden in their hearts and minds. The enormous loss of homeland had left them speechless, unable to speak about what they'd left behind. Thinking, talking, or crying about it was a luxury.
Your parents sacrificed so much. How did that affect you?
Today, I'm very grateful for what they did. Many times, especially as a child and lacking the information and, of course, the maturity to comprehend all the factors contributing to such a decision, was often confusing and sad and scary.
What scared you?
The lack of understanding about what went on before and why we were here.
Because they didn't talk about it.
No.
As you've gotten older, do you have a better sense of what led to their decision to leave the island?
Definitely.
What was the main motivation? I mean, because so many Cubans left, but so many decided to stay, too.
A disagreement with the political problem on the island.
Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts then now, as we see the U.S. opening up travel to Cuba? Have you been back to Cuba?
Yes. I visited Cuba in 2010 and 2011. I haven't been back since. I would like to go back, as I still have some personal history that I need to recover. Mm-hmm. So we'll see when I can make the next trip.
Do you agree with the decision to open up relations? Do you think that was the right decision, or do you think it was a mistake?
I will wait and see. Initially, the terms that were negotiated, I did not feel that we had really gotten a very good deal. However, we'll see.
You're taking a wait-and-see approach. And, you know, I have to say, too, as someone who grew up in the Midwest, to me, cornfields and barns are so unremarkable. But I guess for somebody who'd never grown up in that environment, it would seem completely foreign and strange. And when you grow up, the images that are most resonant with you as a child, they stay with you, those images, those pictures. Mm-hmm. Is that how it is for you when you think back to coming to Minnesota for the first time?
I remember Minnesota as a place of comfort as much as I recall Miami as a place of comfort or Puerto Rico as a place of comfort. My home really is in many places and ultimately within myself.
That's the message behind this memoir, is you carry your home wherever you are. And you're going to be talking about this Saturday at the Florida Heritage Book Festival. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm really happy to be there. It should be a talk. I thought I had said most of what I needed to say when I finished the book. However, I found that still had a few other things I wanted to share with an audience, and so I'll be sharing those comments and also taking questions. A lot of people are interested in Cuba right now.
Definitely. And we're so glad to share this with our listeners, too. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
She's author and Flagler College professor Maricela Vega. Her book is We Carry Our Homes With Us, a Cuban-American memoir, and she will talk about it Saturday at the Florida Heritage Book Festival. So come on out for that. We'll be right back.
WJCT presents Travis Pickney, our 2016 American Graduate Champion of the First Coast, dedicated to mentoring our youth.
The College Red program got started by me looking at students who looked like me, who had the same backgrounds as me, and who were going through the same struggles I was going through in high school.
To hear more stories of champions, watch American Graduate Day on WJCT, Saturday, September 17th at 2 p.m.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
On the next Fresh Air, women's soccer player Abby Wambach, a two-time Olympic gold medalist who scored more goals than any man or woman in soccer history. We'll talk about the game, her injuries, being a lesbian, and her problems with alcohol and prescription drugs. She retired from soccer last year and says she's been sober since last spring. She's written a new memoir. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the regional food bank Feeding Northeast Florida and its national network are mobilizing across the nation this month in an ambitious effort to bring an end to hunger. It's all part of Hunger Action Month this September. Feeding Northeast Florida President and CEO Luke Leo is here with more about food insecurity right here on the First Coast. Good to see you, Luke.
Nice to see you, Melissa.
And Hunger Action Month is really designed to inspire people to take action. 48 million Americans, 15 million children are what are known as food insecure. Can you explain what that is?
The term food insecurity means that somebody does not know where their next meal is going to come from. And here in Jacksonville, that's one in six people. So in our eight-county service area, that's 282,000 people.
That's right. It's a shockingly high number. People, I don't think people realize the scope of the problem very often, which is why I'm glad we could have you on today.
Yeah, thank you. You're absolutely right. I believe that awareness of this issue is one of our primary obstacles. As an example, the feedback that we hear quite often is these people should just go to work. Mm-hmm. Well, the reality is that nearly 60% of them are in fact working. You just heard your previous guest refer to her two parents when they moved to the United States, both working, but not being able to meet.
Not working poor people.
Correct. Working poor is the term. I don't necessarily love it, but that is the common
term. But that is it.
Yes.
People in low-paying jobs that have to make decisions every month about what bills are going to get paid.
If you're a mechanic making, I'm just throwing numbers out there, $30,000 a year, and your spouse is working as a waitress, and you've got three children, it's tough. And Jacksonville ranks, believe it or not, is one of the highest cities in the United States for percentage of income that goes to housing, to mortgage or to rent. You throw a medical problem into that, it's very difficult to feed your family.
Right. And so often what parents will do, as you found, is they'll feed their children maybe, but not themselves.
Correct.
Right?
I'm glad you brought up the children as well. You know, another response to why don't people just get a job? Well, there's 50,000 children under the age of 18 just in Duval County who are food insecure. Are they supposed to go get a job? I mean, somebody needs to look out for them as well.
50% of the kids in the Duval County Public Schools are on the free or reduced lunch program.
Correct. We have a snack pack program. There's several like this. Blessings in a Backpack is one. And we provide 4,000 students every Friday with food to take home. We have 2,500 students on a waiting list. And we're moving towards opening pantries in schools. We have one at Densmore Elementary right now. And that's a movement across the nation with food banks, because now you're not just feeding the child, but you can feed the whole family.
And how is Hunger Action Month helping you move those efforts forward right here in our area?
Well, there's been a lot of awareness. Publix just made a really big announcement a couple weeks ago. They donated $5 million to the Feeding America Network. We received $150,000 here in Jacksonville. If you shop at Publix right now, you'll see the signage for Feeding America all across the store. The call to action that we have in Jacksonville is we're asking people to just come up with whatever you think you would average for lunch today. Just donate that to the food bank. Some food banks would ask you to skip lunch. We're not asking you for that. Just send us what that average might be. And if you want to keep doing that monthly, we'd sure appreciate that as well.
Absolutely. And because as I've learned in talking to you, that Feeding Northeast Florida, and you're an affiliate of Feeding America, people think of it still sometimes as Second Harvest Food Bank, but you're now affiliated with Feeding America, the biggest network in the country for this. You are in charge of delivering food to, I believe it's 17 North Florida counties.
It's now eight. It was.
It's gone down. Okay.
Right. We decided to move, if you will, nine counties under the Central Florida umbrella.
Got it.
That allows them to service those counties, like Gainesville, is a city in that area, more effectively than we can. But it also really allows us to focus on where we live. So it's the eight counties surrounding Duval, including Duval. And that, again, totals 282,000 people in need. So we think eight counties is more than enough. And yes, we are now Feeding Northeast Florida, formerly Second Harvest.
And if people go to your website, feedingnefl.org, and you're challenging them this September, this Hunger Action Month, to just donate one lunch.
Sure.
The cost, if they spend $10 at lunch, donate that amount to give somebody else who's hungry a meal.
Right.
That's not a big ask.
Thank you. I don't think it is. And yes, that would be very nice if people would do that. And again, if they want to continue doing that monthly, that'd be great.
And you also work with a lot of food pantries, churches, mm-hmm. nonprofit organizations. It's a vast network of organizations working on this problem. You're the distributor of all the food, and then it goes out to this spider web of local groups. It's really quite something.
Right. I heard Adam Putnam, our commissioner of agriculture, say a couple weeks ago that hunger is not a supply issue. It's a logistics issue.
Yeah.
And so we are the logistical backbone to source that food and then distribute it. And we do that, as you've mentioned, through 185 community partners. And that's everybody from Sulzbacher Center and Clara White to a host of churches and synagogues.
And they are so vital to this effort. Of course, when we take action and get the food to people who need it, I know you talk with people a lot about the underlying causes of food insecurity. And the politics of it can be difficult. What would you say to those who, you know, they've listened to you talk and they're still not convinced that they might take the attitude, well, if people can't support themselves, why should I help them?
Well, there's always going to be a segment of the population that needs our help. I mean, they're always going to need help for different reasons. Let's just say it's a mental health issue. But again, there's nearly 60% that are working, 20% are veterans, nearly 20% are seniors. So when you really start to look at those numbers, it's a lot more complicated than that. But I would also say that ending hunger and ending poverty are two different things. But you cannot end poverty unless people have been fed. It's really that fundamental. And so the ripple effects of hunger are crime and education and worker productivity and on and on. So we feel that it starts there.
Now, you said that there will be pantries going to more Duval County Public Schools. Where does that stand?
We're working on funding for that right now. We've got a few people that are interested in that. There's a church near Dinsmore Elementary that may be our host for that and distribute the food to those schools. So it's a very preliminary stage in the process, but we're working towards that.
But you need partners for each school.
We do.
People could get in touch with you about that.
They sure could. You sound like a fundraiser, Melissa.
I've learned a thing or two over the years listening to guys like you. So go to feedingnefl.org, feedingnefl.org, this very day, because it's Hunger Action Month all over the country. Did you know that hundreds of thousands of people in our area are food insecure, including lots of kids? Just donate the cost of one lunch to feedingnefl.org. And help feed those that need it most. He is Luke Leo, President and CEO of Feeding Northeast Florida. It's Hunger Action Month. Be a part of the solution. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Next on Diane Rehm, members of more than 200 Native American tribes expand their protests nationwide over the construction of a controversial oil pipeline from North Dakota to Illinois. What's next in the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline and a renewed debate over tribal rights? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. But right now, we want you to support WJCT. Here's how.
All you need to do is pick up your phone and give us a call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org/thank you. Good morning. I'm Kevin Mershart, producer for First Coast Connect. We are here to ask for your support for First Coast Connect and other programs you enjoy here at WJCT and 89.9. It's our fall fund drive. We are over the $14,000 mark, but we're a bit behind for the $72,000 goal that we need to reach by the end of business on Friday. So make that call right now. How about becoming a sustainer at $10 a month? You do that, and we'll send you a nice stainless steel water bottle as our thank you gift to you for your support. Think about all the great programming you hear on WJCT every day, how we bring you a important news, the economic news of the world, the political news, the coverage of the election. And think about how local coverage of elections and the national coverage you get from NPR and how different that is from other places. We don't focus on the little minutia things. We talk about the important issues, the things that are important to you in regard to the election, how this affects your life, how it affects the community, and all the other things that are important to you. We don't have go into shouting matches. We don't have people yelling. We don't get just put on talking heads who just shout at each other back and forth in campaigns. I mean, why would you want to listen to that? Because it doesn't give you any information. It just has people taking cheap shots at each other is something we just don't do around here because we know that you don't want to hear that. There are plenty of places you can go to listen to things like that. But there's only one WJCT here in the Jacksonville area. So call now and show your support. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528.
This is David Green, co-host of Morning Edition. You might have recently heard us talk about something called code switching.
Code switching is the practice of jumping between different language forms in a conversation.
That's Gene Denby. He writes about race and culture for NPR's Code Switch team.
A good example of this might be Tim Kaine at the Democratic National Convention when he's jumping back and forth between Spanish and English.
And we're going to be compañeros de alma in this great lucha ahead.
And one of the reasons that we do this is to signal that we belong to a group. And it usually happens sort of subconsciously. We often don't even realize that we're doing it.
Gene finds that race is one of the defining dynamics of American life. Lately, he doesn't have to look far to find a good story.
This summer, in the age of Donald Trump, in the age of Black Lives Matter, like, it's been impossible to ignore. These stories have been inescapable for all of us. And it feels like we've had some time to sort of sit in this space a little bit. And so we have, like, thoughts and ideas about how to talk about these things. But now we're in this moment in which a lot of people who would probably not think of themselves as people who want to be engaged on issues of race, we've gotten some comments from people who are, like, clearly thinking about this for the first time. And we're trying to find the answers. We're not going to have them. But let's all sort of think out loud together.
An open and honest discussion of race could not come at a better time. And one place you can find it is here on Public Radio. Join us as we think out loud together and try to make sense of today's headlines. Call or go online. Give to this public radio station. The power of your support makes all the difference.
Again, the number is 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. Or you can go online at wjct.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and click on there and also show your financial support for the station. Think about all the great information you get every day, the great conversation that comes through First Coast Connect. We had a nice, great show today. I really enjoyed that. We got to hear Viega, that great story she had as a Cuban-American immigrant. And, of course, Donald Jones' a story about being on that plane on the Hudson and getting to see Sully. I talked to him a little before the show about what he thought, how he went and saw the hit. Talked about that. Talked about seeing the movie when it first came out and its experiences and feelings and what it must be like to sit there and look on the screen and see something that you actually lived through that, and many other people, only a small number of people actually had to experience that event. And hey, as luck would have it, we have someone here to come and talk to you. And he was so willing to, oh, sure, no problem. It was only a few days ago that I was able to set this thing up. And that's the kind of thing that's important because the listeners and the listeners all understand the importance of this program. And so do you. So make that call now. And thank you very much. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.